Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
I am the one who knocks.
You come at the king, you best not miss.
Well, I'm a bunch of little crowd laying motherfucker.
Welcome to the Party Pal, the mind-bending film and television podcast you didn't know you needed. Welcome to Party Pal is a proud member of the Osiris Media Group. Head over to OsirisPod.com, check out all their podcasts, all the live events they get going on. That is OsirisPod.com. Today, we once again celebrate Shogun, the historical drama television miniseries created by Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks. It is based on the 1975 novel by James Clavell, which was previously adapted into a 1980 miniseries. To break it all down, I have with me back on the program Douglas Grant, someone I was really excited to talk about this show with. Douglas is an author, and he has two books that are excellent that I'll point you to. One is Preemptive, and the other is Imaginary Lines, which explores socioeconomic influences in the strained relations between an Irish-American and a Latino family. His works are usually narratives in which he comments on the human condition or on social inequality. We had a great conversation about Shogun, which we examine how faithful FX adaptation was to James Clavell's books, while digging into the overall appeal of the show, considering why it has become such a massive hit. Let's dig right in.
Doug Fresh, welcome back to the program. So glad to have you on to talk about this book. When the show started and it kind of, you started seeing, you know, the trailers and the hype was building, I thought about you because I know this is a, you know, probably source material, you know, about a show I knew you were excited about. I'm so glad to have you here to talk about it. Thanks for coming on the program.
So great to be back. I've been looking forward to this for a while. This show was something else.
Yeah. So overall, before I kind of ask you a few questions I had for you about it, I mean, you were taken by the show in the same way I was. I mean, I just think it's incredible.
Yeah, not only that, but when I saw the first trailer, I never saw the 1980s Richard Chamberlain version. In fact, yeah. I actually rarely watch movies and shows that are based on books I've read. I mean, I do sometimes, so like obviously a sympathizer right now, but yeah. I just sometimes, you know, the adaptation never really holds a torch to the book. I don't know, for whatever reason, I don't.
That's a fair assessment, though. Yeah. That's fair. Yeah.
But when I saw this, it's not only like this is multifaceted. First of all, I've been waiting for a show like this for a while because this period of Japan, feudal Japan, like I feel is just ripe for exploration with a good prestige television show. Furthermore, when I found out they're going to be adapting Shogun, I was like, this is perfect. Like what better novel to adapt to like get a peek into this time period than James Clavell's Shogun. But I also like, it's just like, there's too many times in the last few years where I've wanted something to be good. Like, I want this to be good. And then like, I see it and it's kind of a letdown. So I was a little cautious going into this, like, don't want it too much, like be objective about it and like really be honest with yourself about whether you like this. Well, I thought this show was freaking perfection.
Yeah, that's cool to hear. I'd like to talk a little bit about the appeal of it too. And, you know, you kind of touched on why you were drawn to it, because I was thinking about it a lot, and I'm just so excited too that so many people are drawn to it and it's doing so well, and something so of such high quality is there. And so some of the things I was thinking about when it comes to the appeal is obviously learning a new culture, and this is a culture in a time period that's so fascinating. Obviously amazing drama in this story. It just, you know, all these different deceitful and hidden plans and everything there. Historically, you're learning a lot about things, but then I've just been thinking a lot about these characters and why some of them I like that I almost shouldn't, and just kind of, it just leads you to a space where you're thinking about the dichotomy and complexity of people. I mean, it kind of harkens back to, you know, how excited we were about the anti-heroes and kind of like that peak TV era. It's wild how people who kind of do messed up things in this show, like Boil Another Human, become some of my favorite characters. And so I've just kind of thinking about all these different aspects and why I like this show so much and why I like, you know, why so many like the show so much. And that kind of unique appeal of these unique, I mean, this idea that there is a lot of nuance to us as humans. We're not all good. We're not all bad. We're, you know, a lot in between is really something that I keep thinking about when I think about the show.
Yeah. And what makes this so much more nuanced is it's like this, for lack of a better term, culture clash. Like the Japanese culture at this time holds human life in such a different paradigm than the European powers that are trying to like break in there. And like going back to what you just said, I guess we're going to already address the guy getting boiled alive. So I might as well just go with it. I knew that was coming. I was good for it, and I was just like, this is going to be hard to watch. But I had to remind myself, because a friend of mine was like, I had to jump off the show after that. But you have to remind yourself that you don't get much of the backstory on Blackthorne and his crew, but they were murderers. They were raiders. They were, yeah. So when you see that guy get thrown in that boiling pot, you just like, whatever you got to do to make yourself feel better, you're just like, all right, well, that guy's a murderer.
That guy's a bad person. He's pillaged and done all those things, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean. It's weird. Yabushige, he is a character that, and by the way, I'm going to try and refrain from being like the book, the movie, the series, the book.
Sure,
series.
No, but also, I'd like to hear anything you have to say about that too. Because in the last episode we did, this is a follow up to it. We didn't really talk about that because I haven't read it, and I'm glad to talk to someone who knows it so well.
Yeah, so I will say that these characters, I think were almost 100% perfectly cast. Like,
oh, cool.
Every actor portrayed their character perfectly, in my opinion, and they were like really well cast. Blackthorne, Toranaga, all of them.
Yep.
I found Yabushige though to be a bit of a deviation from the source material in terms of like, he in the book, he just seems very, very shrewd. He is playing both sides, but he's doing it in his own interests, and he's always kind of scheming and like he's got machinations happening behind the scenes. The Yabushige we get in this show, like I feel for him because he's just getting bounced back and forth like a ping pong. Ishida, Toranaga, he's just like, what am I supposed to do here?
Totally.
But
it was something endearing about that too, which was really, really wild. Like I said, like it's funny how much we all like them, because I mean, he's turning on characters you like. He's obviously he's a full on schemer, and I usually wouldn't like a full on schemer, and I was definitely drawn to that. I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about, I mean, some, from everything I can tell, and just I've listened to a bunch of interviews with Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo, who are the showrunners of the show. They really did a great job of sticking to the book where they could. And there were some differences I noticed. I was wondering anything jumped out at you. One they talk about a lot is how, Blackthorne was going to attempt, that ritual suicide in what would be episode 4. It was much earlier in the book. He ended up doing it later on the road. From what they were saying, they didn't feel it was earned at that point. He wasn't to the point where he, you know, would understand a tradition in that way. So that was one of the big changes. And that made sense to me. Obviously they shifted points of emphasis from Blackthorne to a lot of these Japanese characters, which I love that decision. There was also one thing that I thought was really cool that was cut out. They cut that the book's epilogue. There's an epilogue in which Toranaga executes Ishido by burying him up to his head and leaving him exposed. So those were the main ones I saw. Could you talk a little bit about whatever differences or anything that you had in mind about that?
Yeah, the epilogue happens very abruptly. Yeah. And I kind of like how it's handled in the show, because when Toranaga's talking to Yabushige at the end, like they set the stage for that whole battle scene that's about to happen. And you know, when Lady Ishida pulls out that Ishido is just screwed, like, and you know his defeat is imminent. Yeah. And also, like, there was some kind of backstory there where Toranaga had talked to a soothsayer who predicted that he was going to die in battle. But I thought the ending was handled beautifully. And I think that was warranted that they pushed his attempt to do seppuku towards later in the novel. Yeah. There were some minor differences that I thought were kind of just like, for the sake of the plot, I thought that like, it was probably a good idea that they just moved past it. Like there's, you remember when Yabushige's like caught in the bottom of that canyon when the tides come in and he's resigning himself to death. Well, there's in the book, there's a scene
when he like pulls out his sword. I was like trying to fight the ocean or something. I thought it was a really strange place to kind of do seppuku.
Well, what's funny is, so in the novel, there's one of his men actually jumps off the cliff and lands next to him and kills him to get his attention. So he looks up. And the reason that was kind of a pivotal moment in the book is because that, I remember in the novel, that's when Blackthorne is just like, these people are crazy. What's going on right
now? Oh, really? Yeah. I mean, at that point, he doesn't understand any of their traditions at all, any of their cultural differences at all. Right,
right, exactly. Yeah. And that's when it starts to dawn on him. Like, this is, I am not anywhere, this is a foreign land.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
After Mariko's death, when Blackthorne gets escorted back to Toranaga, Father Alvito tells him in the woods, yeah, we were going to murder you in this woods, but Mariko intervened. In the novel, he actually gets down to the docks where the boat's going to take him away, and they have like a pyre ready to burn him alive, like that.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, man, I can't remember what happens that intervenes and saves his life, but like he came within an inch of getting burned alive in that. So that was a pretty big difference, but. Honestly, I thought that was a very faithful adaptation. Like, there wasn't anything that jumped out at me that was like, all right, that's... And honestly, when he was about to cut Mariko's head off in the end, when she's about to commit seppuku herself, I couldn't remember exactly. I was like, oh, is this how they're going to do it? And then when Ishida comes in the end and gives her her papers, I'm like, oh, no, this is... So now she thinks she's getting away. And the audience now, if they don't know the source material, they think her life's been spared. But I'm like, this is where the shinobi are going to come in later. Yabushige is going to let them in. Yeah. And that was a very faithful adaptation of the way she dies, because that's exactly how it happens in the book.
And they have the conclusion that anyone who wasn't familiar with the source material is actually kind of, you know, the discussion about it is that they're surprised that there wasn't this bigger battle. And so that is something that didn't take place in the book, which is pretty wild.
Yeah, I wanted to speak to that because
I'd love to hear.
This series almost looks like it is building towards some type of great big Braveheart Game of Thrones clash on the battlefield.
Even the image they show, like if you look at the poster of it, I mean, he's got his sword out, he's running through the field with samurai gear.
Even in the intro with all the arrows flying.
Absolutely.
But then you realize the whole point is Toranaga sends in Mariko. She is the one who saves the day. She is the reason that this
guy.
Yeah, exactly. She so is Crimson Sky.
Yep.
And that's why I think she was worthy of her own episode. The penultimate episode was like Toranaga wasn't even in it. It was all about her and her sacrifice. Mm-hmm. What else did I want to say? It had to do with the deep. One thing that kind of miffed me, and I did not go run to the internet to look it up, was when Blackthorne he wakes up from the explosion, they have these flash forwards to when he's like in old and in bed, and then they're like, grandfather, did you really get this from a savage? I don't know if he's just dreaming about a future that didn't happen, because
it's an unrealized future.
Yeah, because he never leaves Japan.
No,
and
the only way I could tell that's the case is the rosary that's in his hand that he's holding, which is the one that he drops in the water.
Right.
So there's some idea of what could be that isn't going to happen.
Exactly, and also he doesn't want to leave Japan, and in the book, he starts to realize how clean everything is, and like he really embraces this culture. He thinks about back home in England, how dirty his home is and all that. Mm-hmm. And he, at one point, he's like, this place is paradise. So it's not so much that Toranaga is holding him against his will, but in book six of this series, his descendants show up, and they're 100%, not 100%, but they're definitely Japanese. And, so the fact that he has these like two European grandsons, I was like, this must be a dream about what he thinks is his future. I might be wrong. Maybe I'll find out later.
I think you might be right. That's all I'm seeing about. So you mentioned book six. There's how many books are in the series?
There are six books in the series. They're very loosely connected.
Got it.
Shogun is not the first one that he published. The first one he published is called King Rat, and it's almost it's loosely autobiographical at the time. James Clavell was a prisoner of war during World War II. But Shogun is easily his best book. I think everyone would agree with me. And it's the first one that takes place on the chronological timeline, the 1600s.
Oh, cool. I'm hearing a lot about Gaijin, which translates to foreigner as one. That's pretty special.
That's the only other one that takes place in Japan. And if I'm not mistaken, that's the last one he published before his death. Blackthorne, it's funny because when he says this place is paradise, I was also, I don't know, I guess I don't know as much about the weather as I thought I'd do in Japan, because it was a very murky setting most of the time. Yeah. And this is coming from someone who was in the Pacific Northwest. So. But I was just like always cloudy and foggy. I was like, all right, well, I got to check this out and find out, because I plan on going to Japan as soon as I can. And absolutely. But those sets were beautiful. I mean, it almost had kind of a, not quite a Zack Snyder color palette, but like,
yeah,
the scenery was very, very beautiful and engaging.
Yeah. So Torunaga is someone I've been thinking a lot about, and just like his motives, you know, which kind of underlie the whole, you know, season. And I just keep thinking about, you know, him being told, you know, you know, when the actual reveal of what he's doing happens, he goes, you know, he hears, you're no better than the rest of us in your secret heart. And it just, it's, I didn't see, you know, we all knew there was a plan going and everything like that. But I mean, I talked a little bit about this in the last episode, but I mean, it's interesting that he did have those ambitions and he did want to become, there was more of a search for power and hope for power in him than I thought. And I think it almost felt like that was kept away from us till that moment. Is there anything like you want to speak on with that? Or was that something that maybe even in the book, there was something that, you know, it was present in him, or you could see it in him? Or was it something that kind of shocked you as well?
It didn't shock me so much. I'm getting ready for me to get nerdy here. It didn't shock me.
That's what I'm here for.
Yeah. It didn't shock me. I think like his ambitions align with, I think this is my take on it, is that he truly felt he was the one who was just been chosen to keep the realm together.
Yeah.
And he did covet the Shogun position, but he was kind of third in succession. All right, so Torunaga is based on a real life Tokugawa Ieyasu, who basically unified all of Japan in the 1600s and then closed its doors to foreign. I think like he let a few Dutch traders operate near like Nagasaki or something, but, and you know, I'd probably get torn apart by anyone who listens to this and like, no, that's not how it happened. But
But I mean, he ushered in like hundreds of centuries of peace.
Yeah. He came on the heels of, they keep referring to the Taiko, and the Taiko was based on Hideyoshi. Hideyoshi was like the right-hand man of, if you remember, Nobunaga from another series we talked about.
Yep.
And I believe that Mariko is the daughter of the person who betrays Nobunaga, and Nobunaga ends up committing seppuku while he's under attack. And then there's just kind of this power vacuum and Hideyoshi takes over. But when Hideyoshi dies, Nobunaga, like Japan is in at risk of like falling apart, and Torunaga is, I'm sorry, now I'm talking about fictional characters again. Torunaga is like, all right, it's on me now. I'm going to be Shogun. I've got to keep this realm. It can't be a Shido, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's an arrogance there, but I mean, it's funny. I mean, it turned out to be right, which is really, really amazing. I'd like to talk a little bit about the production of it too, because I just keep thinking about how it's the care the showrunners put into the show, just and like what they did to do it. And so Hiroyuki, just this amazing actor, I mean, he was pulled in initially to not only just be kind of like the centerpiece actor in it, he was brought on to be involved in the entire production. He was looking at scripts with them. He's a producer on the show. Just to kind of continue what you know, Justin and Rachel wanted to do. They ran scripts through Japanese translators and dialogue polishers. They really focused. They weren't going to get, you know, kind of pull into this white savior trap that it turns out the 1981 did. They made this massive document detailing the customs, culture, and history of Japan. Specialists were hired to kind of cast a critical eye on how the culture was represented. They didn't mess around, and I mean, it's so obvious that this is something that they were trying to do right. They were trying to make sure, you know, all these mistakes that have been made throughout decades and you know, of film and television production, when talk about, you know, this end of the earth or different cultures, haven't been made. And it just matters so much. I just think that's so special.
It does matter. I'm glad you said that, because it was like, first of all, like, I've seen so much stuff that is just so lazy, so they can tap in lazy Western audiences. Like,
yes,
the fact that it was in Japanese and we had to read subtitles 90% of the time.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was so fate, like just these small details of the culture. When he catches the pheasant, I'm like, uh-oh, like there goes the gardener. But yeah, and that matters. And also, yeah, I was worried because, as you know, in 2024, we've moved well away from the white savior trope, but like, yeah, it's easy to fall into the trap where like, well, wasn't Blackthorne the white savior? He wasn't. He even Toranaga says himself towards the end, he's like, yeah, I would have won this without this guy, but you know,
I kept him around for a laugh.
Yeah, he kept him around for a laugh. Yeah, and you know, one of my favorite scenes is when, after they put the gardener to death over the pheasant, yep, Toranaga goes up to him and is just like, you guys don't value life, I want out of here and all that, and you know, appeals to him, and then Toranaga just like I don't have time for this.
Like, beat it, buddy. I don't need this Western individualism here.
Hirayoki is, I've been a fan of his for a while. I thought he was he showed up in Westworld. He played Musashi. I thought he was awesome. He was even in Last Samurai, if I remember correctly.
Yep. No, I saw a picture of him in it today. Yeah, absolutely was. Yeah.
Phenomenal actor. And perfect, like I said, perfectly cast for this role.
I know that's one thing that's real special about this is, I mean, we're seeing the shine get to it. I mean, I just saw Anna, who plays Maroki on like Colbert the other night, and just, I mean, people are raving about it. I mean, I think she's Emmy bound. I mean, episode 9, I haven't seen an actor or actress control an episode like that in a long time. That was absolutely stunning. People are falling for, is it Tadanobu?
Yep.
Yep. People are really, I'm seeing him get praise everywhere, which is so cool to me. I want to see him on other things. I want to revisit their work, their Japanese work. It's exciting.
That's why when I said that I didn't think like his character was in line with what I had read in the novel,
yeah,
it's important that he did play that character the way he did, because then it wouldn't have drove home the final scene between him and Toranaga. And I don't think like the character I knew from the novel couldn't have had such an intense dialogue with Toranaga before he gets his head cut off. And, you know, he's a phenomenal actor. He played Genghis Khan in the film Mongol way back in like late 2000s, early 2010s.
Yeah.
And they never made a sequel to that, but he is a really good actor. And
he's Hogan in the Thor movies too.
Yeah.
He doesn't get much play.
But going back to what you said about like them wanting to be this a faithful adaptation in terms of like attention to detail, one of the things I really loved about this show was that so much was communicated with so little body language.
Uh-huh.
It was communicated in facial expressions. It was communicated in mood and even the score. To give you an example, when Blackthorne's talked, like when Toranaga has Blackthorne telling him about the guns in Macau, and then he's like, tell me more about like what these European powers think of like Japan. And then he finds out through Blackthorne that like the Portuguese, the British, and you know, that these warring factions of Christianity are carving up like Asia, like in terms of trade and all that, like, and are talking about how they own like these places. Like, just, you can, without like any change in facial expression, you can see Toranaga just get like real serious quickly. And like, that was giving me goosebumps in a way that some of the like the most larger than life acting scenes, like with drama and yelling and around, because so much is communicated with so little, and that's kind of the way it was there, you know.
I think that it almost speaks to the way the whole thing landed. It was it was this super powerful quiet that,
yes,
that really, really came out, and that's, I love that a conversation between two people that like it just, that was it, that was what brought it home. And that, I mean, there was big moments that led to it and the whole thing. I've been thinking a lot about language and the way language was represented. There was poetry in it. There was just kind of the idea of language kind of seeping through the whole thing. I mean, language is what brought these two couples together. I really liked the romance. I thought it was really, really cool. Language is what brought them together. There was a loneliness that he had that is caused by language disconnect of being in a culture in an area where you know, you don't know the language. That's pretty intense, and that made their connection stronger because that's all they had. The showrunner's languages decisions were really cool to me, like the fact that, you know, Portuguese was English, and you know that idea also that over 70% of the lines are delivered in Japanese. I thought that was, you know, kind of that was almost brave in this world. And I love that that came off. And just there's just all these powerful lines about language too. And I mean, Maruka, she has one I love. If I could use words like scattering flowers and falling leaves, what a bonfire my poems would make. And there was just like a power to the language they use, to the idea of language in it. Was that striking you as well?
It was. There were a lot of poignant moments delivered through the haikus that the characters were giving to each other, and hers was, you know, the most powerful of them. Like, and I like that Lady Oshiba took it upon herself to finish her poem. If I remember correctly, in the book, it's actually Latin that's their common language.
Oh wow!
Because she's a Christian, she learns Latin, and so she doesn't speak English. He speaks Latin, she speaks Latin, so that's how they communicate. But I think, you know, with everything going on and the story is just so jam-packed, I think having them speak Portuguese to each other was a good choice. One thing I really appreciated was, you know, it takes up seconds on the screen, but I think it was really important to see what Blackthorne would say. Mm-hmm. And then hear her translation of it, because he told
her a lot of good jokes out there about it. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but there's a lot of good jokes. Like, he'll be going on and like say like three or four sentences, and she'll say two words. But what were you saying, please?
That kind of reminds me of Lost in Translation.
That's exactly what people are referencing to. Yeah,
but no, it's just like she didn't take too many liberties with like what Blackthorne said something. She would say, like, Toranaga's like, don't mess around. Tell me exactly what he's saying. And she would say it pretty much to the letter. Sometimes she would dress it up a little or massage it a little just for etiquette's sake. But like, and you know, it's like the viewer, like, do we really want to sit through the same line of dialogue twice when we want to keep the show moving along? But that was important to see that.
It was funny just to see what, as it kind of the show kind of ran along, what themes would really stick out to me. I really thought initially I'd be thinking a lot about religion as a means of colonization, which is there. It's definitely a huge part of it. And, you know, the two different people, whatever, England versus Catholics and the whole thing there. And just that. But like that, I didn't harp on that as much. I mean, obviously, it's hard not to think about as you know, religion to this day I'm wondering what type of, you know, religious hardcore crazies are going to get us all killed. That's
right
to worry about. But that was, I mean, there's all these different themes, and I was thinking about the East versus West mentality a lot, and that was super important to get into it. But it's so funny how many, it's so interesting how many different aspects they are to think about with this. And just, I mean, are there any themes that we haven't touched on or anything that like really stick out to you? I mean, I also love the idea of Blackthorne kind of switching from his Western individualism to kind of starting to truly understand the Japanese devotion to duty and sacrifice. And sacrifice is probably one of the biggest themes. I mean, just the idea of sacrificing yourself, all these, that was in almost every episode. Any themes that really resonated with you as you went along?
Well, with religion, I like kind of like it's touched upon, because if you know this period in history, you know that the Christians are not long for this country in terms of like what they're going to tolerate. If I'm not mistaken, like the doors start to get closed. Like, I think the real life Iyasu saw the danger in the spread of Christianity and started to shut it down. And that's handled really well in Martin Scorsese's Silence. We didn't get too much into that, because it was more about how religion is leveraged for wealth and prosperity, and less about like, is this person a devout Christian? Are they a true follower of Jesus? But just the theme of human life, and you know, some people, anyone who'd say like Blackthorne's the white savior, I see him more as a lens. He's like the lens that a Western audience can look through to get perspective of like a European stepping into this foreign land and just being like, oh my, like these people commit suicide over what? Like they killed my gardener because of a pheasant, you know, like just the shock and awe. But to them, it's as normal as anything else. It's like you've dishonored your family. And like, you know what they didn't really dwell on is when her husband has to commit seppuku and she has to part ways with her son. You know, it happens off screen, but like she's obviously in pain, but she, you know, she, there's she doesn't dwell on it. She moves on with her life. Like, she's like, this is my duty. My family's been put to death over this dishonor, that this shame that my family can't handle. And I mean, to us, that's the, to see a toddler be put to death over this. Like, you're just like, you know, it does.
Unfathomable.
Yeah.
Of course. Absolutely. What the showrunners did a good job of saying, what they, they've been, like I said, I've kind of been, it's crazy how much stuff is out there on the internet about Shogun. If Reddit's blowing up.
It's a big hit.
It's a hit. It makes me so happy. So I've been listening to a lot of interviews with the showrunners. They've been, you know, kind of doing a little celebration tour almost, because it's exciting for them. But they do talk about how Blackthorn is the audience. That is, he represents all of us watching, and like him coming to grips with it and experiencing it. And I just think that's a cool way. You said it perfectly, lens. So, and when I was reading more about reading into it, and it kind of, you know, I knew you'd help me with this, and thank you for talking about some of the book differences and ideas present in it. But so many people back in the day when the book came out, I'm seeing like this was like an introduction to Japanese culture, even though it's like far, you know, 1600s Japanese culture, but it really caught their eye. It kind of just opened a door to a culture. And I think that's kind of the power of the book and now the show. It's introduced Japanese culture to many more people now, and they did, because they did it so faithfully and, you know, put so much into it, it's been done respectfully, which is necessary when you're doing that. But I just think that's kind of beautiful to see as we're celebrating this episode. Isn't that cool?
It is. And going back to what I said at the very beginning about how I've been waiting for a show like this, like, you know how nerdy I am with stuff like this. Like, I've watched a million shows about samurai and ninja, and I take it all in. And a lot of them are made in Japan, and they're some of them are low budget, and some of them are very like contained in story about like a few specific characters. Mm-hmm. So when I say I've been waiting for something kind of like on an epic scale with political intrigue and like the fall of empires and leaders clashing, and I like was just waiting for something like this to come along and shed light on a big spotlight on this culture where I just think has some of the best opportunities for storytelling. And, you know, that's why the novel hit with me when I read it. I think I read it 12 years ago. Like this novel really, and it's interesting. Have you seen any criticism about it? Not like, cause there are some really great novels that are almost as revered as this one that have been written by Japanese authors. But like, have you seen anything like criticism that it was James Clavell who had to bring this to us? You know what I mean?
No. I think there's a little bit resonating, but the idea that he also, from what I can tell, fell in love with the culture and started to respect the culture when he was over there as a POW for that reason. Like, his experience, it does have parallels to Blackthorn's in that he didn't know what the hell was going on, and then he's like, wow, this is pretty interesting. And I think that's respectful.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So I just, well, you know what, you and I both know with some of the mutual stuff we love, too much of a good thing is a bad thing.
I feel like
I've been eating ice cream with a lot of the IPs that I've been fed for a while, to my detriment, because I'm not in love with some of the things I've used to love with as much as I did. That being said, I love the idea that this might open the door to more, like, you know, shows about or movies about samurai. But I don't want this to be like the next Vikings, you know what I mean? Like, a few years ago, I liked Vikings, and then it's like, I got Vinland Saga, and I got The Last Kingdom and The Northmen, and I got two more Vikings that I can handle. So while I say I've been waiting for something like this that explores Japan and like the intricacies of this culture, especially Bushido and the way of the warrior, I'd like to just sit and digest on this a while. I'm not even really welcoming a season two. There is no source material for a season two. And I think it was wrapped up so perfectly to go beyond it. I don't want it.
I really hope they do. And I'm hoping that, just like you're saying, that taking all that care and raising the bar to this whole thing, that people might be wary of bringing some trash to these type of stories. And this was so special that if you try to follow suit and don't do it right, it's not going to work out. And I hope they know that, because I mean, this was awesome. This was a really, really special show, and it's something I talked about in the last episode. There's a lot of rewatch value to me. There's a lot of nuances I know I missed. I learned a lot from you today hearing this, and I'm gonna continue kind of digging in and find out. And any final thoughts about Shogun as we wind down this episode?
I'm highly satisfied. I think before we started today, you and I talked about the state of prestige television, peak TV, and all that. And I do, I think this is just a jewel in the rough. Like, I think, I hope this show reinvigorates good storytelling and taking source material seriously and just giving us a good story. Let's face it, there's so many people who've fallen in the followed on the heels of our beloved Sopranos, Breaking Bads, and Wires that have just missed the mark. I think this is a really special show, and it's because you can tell the showrunners took the time to craft a really great story, to pay attention to those details, and to really just love the source material that they're working with and bringing it to us in 2024.
It's cool because you can, with all that's out there, you can really tell when a showrunner loves source material. You can tell when they put in everything they have into it and try to do it right. You can see it. We felt it here. It's awesome. Hey, thank you for coming on. You haven't been on the program in a little bit. Good to have you back. I know this is something you cared about, so I've been dying to hear your thoughts. So thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Mike. This was great.
And thank you, everybody out there, for once again, join the party.
Osiris. This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris Podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with live experiences and podcasts about artists and topics you love. Get in the loop at osirispod.com.